What's up, everybody, and welcome to episode 131 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, aka All Day Ray, aka the Superman Lover. And I'm joined here by my whimsical co-host, former market maker of 20 years and current day retail trading educator, the legendary stock promoter of House Street, who's moved more paper than Kinko's, the Silverback. JJ, how's it going?
Good, brother. Good. Really excited. This is I love having first we had Hunter, now we've got Jeff, and I'm super stoked as I learn about this business.
Absolutely. Me too, man. We're big fans of the guys over at Bitwise. And so our guest today, he's the head of Alpha Strategies and portfolio manager at Bitwise Asset Management, former partner at Corbin Capital and a derivatives trader at Morgan Stanley, the founder of the Radical Portfolio Theory, Stanford alum, and one of the best economic thinkers today. I'm talking about Jeff Park. Jeff, thanks for joining us, man. How's it going?
Thanks for having me, Ray. And you're making me blush already to a conversation we haven't even yet begun. So honored to be here. And
Awesome.
131, let's go. Love prime numbers. I think it's prime
Yeah.
number. Is that a prime number? Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, you're gonna know better than me, Jeff. So I'll leave that up to you. It's a prime number. So no, just man, just real pumped to talk to you, man. I really enjoy reading and listening to the stuff that you put out on the internet. Really helps shape and inform like the way I think about things. And I'm going to attempt to keep up with you today, but please forgive me if I fail. But I'm just curious, like, what led you into a career in finance?
That's a good question. I think early on, I didn't really know finance was an industry. I think much like many people who don't really have the ability to see it unless you have parents in it or friends in the space. But I think for me, like the thing that I really appreciated about my internships throughout my college years was really getting your hands dirty in the capital markets, where you can do a lot of things with numbers. And I've always had a real kind of interest in math and wanted to think about how that could be applied in ways that is actually maybe a little bit more useful than the theories. And when I discovered trading as a profession, it blew my mind that that's actually something you could do as a career to contribute towards the functioning of a well-lubricated capital markets here in the United States. So, I started my career, my college education, really thinking I was going to go to medical school. I was pre-med. Econ was more of like an interest, so I double majored with the idea of just doing something that I like, and then eventually over time realized the thing that I like is the thing that I think about all the time, and was able to kind of make this transition throughout the years.
That's cool. That's cool. When you first started, I guess like thinking about markets, and trading, did you dabble a little bit like on your own before you got in the industry?
I did, yeah. I think I got my first trading account when I was in high school. And it's
Wow.
probably a similar to many people. Your parents give you a little bit of cash and say, hey, pick stocks you like, do some research, understand how the market kind of behaves and think about portfolio construction. And I think for at the beginning it was more of like a passion project of like doing value investing, if you will, like trying to find like mid caps and small caps that you might not otherwise hear about and you'd be really proud of kind of the research engine behind it. And then when I was at college, I actually joined a student investment club. It was called the Blythe Fund, and it still exists today. And what it is actually a student-led investment club that manages a real sum of capital on behalf of the endowment in the ways that you can actually donate back some of the profits to the university. That's like a really mission-aligned way to have, students think about investing for the greater good and the public good of the university. And I eventually became the president of that investment club to really think about investing more in a diversified way as a potential career. That's what ultimately led me to Wall Street and my summer internships and trading. And then you just realize the paper portfolio experience with the cash account in your high school to the transition to like a real book on the sell side is actually quite a journey that I think some people get to experience in different levels of the microcosm.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like to ask you a little bit about that journey and your career before Bitwise. So you might just tell us a little bit there and like what you learned from that to brought you into Bitwise.
Yeah, so I started my career at Morgan Stanley, as you've mentioned, and I was an exotic equity derivatives trader. And I was given actually several books in my internship to get you accelerated on what the journey of being a trader in life would actually be like. And one of the books that was given to me was Market Wizards. I don't know if you ever came across those books, but it
We've
just
had
there's
the
I think
author
they're
on.
humble.
Yeah, we've had the
Oh,
author.
amazing! You've had Jack. Oh, amazing! That's great. I'll have to catch that episode. But to me, it was an eye-opening book just because, like, you get to learn about the experiences of seasoned traders and the way that they get to share some life and advice. But you're also so young that you don't actually know how to interpret those advice at the time. And it's one of those classic books that you can revisit over and over, I think, actually, throughout in your entire career and pick up lessons because the framing of the context of the market changes with you. And but there are some things that really at the core remain the same. And I think the core thing that really remains the same, and something that I've been practicing for the last 15 years of my own career is in investing to really be exceptional, to be the top one percentile, right? People ask all the time, like, what is that trait? And with many professions, you might say expertise, like kind of like, oh, if you want to be the top, like, cancer immunology researcher, like just having expertise in the subject matter is what makes you top one percentile. And same with kind of empirical sciences. But the thing that's really unique about investing, actually, I think it's about dynamism. It's actually the ability to be versatile and adaptable and changing your minds pretty easily and unapologetically in ways that the journey itself takes a long time for people to master that skill. So when I think about that one universal, timeless, exceptional trait of like a good trader or a good investor, it's really having an open mind to being totally adaptable for the moment and having no ego about it. And in that sense, I think when I discovered Bitcoin, it was really easy for me because I had no ego about what Bitcoin represented. I just really thought it was interesting, understood the quantitative features to be really interesting relative to other traditional assets as the way I would appreciate as a derivatives trader. And my journey to Bitcoin started with a little bit more of like a bent towards that aspect of trading, as it then slowly became a more social and philosophical mission over time. That was also pretty natural to me in the ways that it represented my own belief system. But the key here being the journey that I landed through Bitwise and all of my 15 plus year career from Morgan Stanley to the Harvard Endowment to Corbin Capital to here, I think is because of that trait that I think is so important for investors, which is adaptability and just knowing how to seize those opportunities and being able to recognize it as the markets are always ever changing. So whatever domain expertise you had 5 years ago, probably irrelevant from 10 years ago, probably won't be relevant 5, 10 years ago. Of course, they're important foundations, but the market changes and you have to adapt.
Well said. That's incredible. I mean, I guess like what a good like life skill too, because I feel like you markets can help reflect life in a lot of respects. And JJ, I think about like we always joke like sometimes how it's like hard for like lawyers or doctors or like people of other
Oh,
professions
yeah.
to exceed well in trading, because I think they're used to maybe like this is
They're not
always
used
this where
to being wrong, right? Like my girlfriend, she's an MD double PhD, right? Brilliant. But in trading, when she's wrong, you could just see her get angry, right? So, like, I mean, I was pre-med too, but I became a bouncer. So Jeff is I it's great because, if my mom was alive, she'd be like, "See, why couldn't you be like him?" Right?
I don't know.
But
Bouncing sounds like a fun gig. You'll have to tell me your history of that one day as well,
oh
JJ.
dear God, I got too many stories. But go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's great. That's great. No, that was well said, Jeff. That was awesome. And that's what I loved about those Market Wizard books is like seeing like the and we've had some of the traders on as well that were featured in those books. And just how like they could all come from different approaches, but then like you're saying, like there's those that underlying like dynamism or just like there's going to be certain principles and fundamentals that never change no matter how much things do change. You brought up obviously, when you first got into Bitcoin, and that's something I was going to ask you about, like your first thoughts about when you first encountered it. But you answered that already. I guess like so, this was an easy thing for you to come into. I guess what was the first time you heard about Bitcoin?
Yeah, the first time I heard about it was on the trading desk at Morgan Stanley. In a way, I think a lot of traders got exposed to it pretty early on because there actually was a little bit of like a vibrant community of poker players who actually would look at Bitcoin as also a way to think of it as a capital conduit. And it could be a passing moment when you just kind of learn about it and then you realize it's nothing. Or there are some people who gravitate towards asking, wait, what is this actual thing? And then can I double click on it? And I started my career in 2008. So there's also a class of traders and investors who understood in the very beginning of their career, the financial crisis set the mood for what is possible and what is not possible in the institutional way that challenges everything you've ever learned about the world growing up and going to school and things like that. So I think that's why when I first discovered Bitcoin, I was more open-minded in the ability to see what it could represent, because once like you see how crazy the financial system actually is, anything's possible. You realize like the fiction of money and the trust exercise of the dollar hegemony itself is all foundational upon very much a core principle, which is do people believe it? And it would take a long time for us to be here today with you in the way Bitcoin has become mainstream. But at the very beginning, you could tell like there was a lot of interest around that from the lens of like the long history with the cypherpunk movement. The thing too for me as a trader that really appealed to me about Bitcoin was that it was just extremely unlikely that it could maybe succeed at the beginning, to the way that if it did succeed, you knew that the outcome would be more meaningful than you could ever imagine. And this is the thing about humans. One of the reasons why humans are actually just bad traders is because we're not wired to think about distribution of outcomes in a way that we
Exactly.
always underestimate tail events. And my job as an exotic trader is to actually worry about tail events. Everything that I priced in the options market were exotic instruments that concern themselves to like unmodelable volatility features that requires stochastic modeling and not like a local volatility close-end deterministic solution. So I'm thinking about every day, what is the tail risk? How could that tail risk happen? And what is the severity of that event if it were to happen? And humans are really bad at one, the probability of tail events, but two, the other thing that they're really bad at is the severity of the event. They have a really hard time understanding things at an exponential level, where if it were to be a thing that mattered, they don't know how to actually guard that like monumental thing into a way that can be comprehensible. So the thing about Bitcoin that was so interesting to me from the beginning was it seemed so unlikely to succeed. And yet if it were to succeed, the prize would be, heaven and earth. And that is fundamentally the thing that gravitates, I think, people that are like-minded about quantitative finance as I am. And so you see the volatility, you see the distribution of fad events, you see actually the autocorrelated nature of how a Bitcoin moves, which is that momentum and trend is one of the most powerful signal as to how Bitcoin price action behaves. There's just a lot of interesting things you can trinkle with to really get into the sandbox of crypto in ways that you couldn't really with other traditional assets. And that's, I think, where my journey really began in earnest.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah, and those are the type of bets you want to make, right there. Jeff, you were you a serious poker player? You mentioned poker players embracing Bitcoin.
I mean, I'm not serious in that I was ever like world ranked or participated in public tournaments, but I think you'll find almost all traders on Wall Street
We're
went through
playing
the
poker.
underground circuit of New York City in some fashion or another.
Yeah,
My one
that.
my one claim to fame is that actually one of my friends is actually a really good poker player, world ranked, and he is very good friends with Vanessa Selbst. And
Okay.
hosted like a ch like almost like a charity tournament once where the bounty was knocking her out, and I was the person that knocked out
You
Vanessa self, so I got a little trophy. I think that was probably the peak of my poker career.
Sweet, man. Sweet. Yeah, no, that's how I got into trading. I was a poker player for many years, and that's how I got introduced to Bitcoin. It was a way for me to get onto some of these offshore sites with online poker getting banned in the US. And so it was, and then I guess like, when we talked to Hunter, and the CEO of Bitwise, I thought something interesting he mentioned, and I don't know why I never thought of Bitcoin in this manner before, but he was saying how like pe different people are drawn to Bitcoin for different reasons, and there's like this fears of like overlap. Like you have the people who are interested in the tech, you have the finance side, and then like the ideological side of it as well. I assume it's probably all three for you, or is there any one maybe area that's resonates more with you?
Yeah, great question, right? I think for me, I agree with you completely that Bitcoin's like a little bit of a mirror. Like everyone projects what they want Bitcoin to represent as it is important to themselves. And actually, I think that's why so many times you have these conversations about is Bitcoin a security? Is it a commodity? Is it a currency? And the answer is it's all or none. It's actually anything that you could ever want it to be in the ways that Bitcoin can be fungible towards your own value system. So your question is totally appropriate as to the journey that can look different across many. But I do think the end state is pretty similar, which is the unifying theme of Bitcoin, nonetheless, is the imagination of a non-custodial ownership of a financial asset that lets you have many degrees of freedom that the current traditional system probably does not promote in the methods of centralization as it exists today. And for me, it is a philosophical and a spiritually important journey as well. You know, I mentioned to you, I started my career in 2008. So to be told when you graduate college, the world is your oyster, and then you realize actually everything you ever thought was going to be the thing that you would do is totally made irrelevant by the unshakable kind of, you know, craziness of like the actual foundations of the global financial system. It's pretty unnerving. But the thing that I think I was also very lucky to have experienced is I had that journey even earlier, which was actually 20 years ago. Oh, actually not 20, yeah, 10 years ago from graduation, which was the 1997 Asian financial crisis. And I was only in elementary school at the time, but what you do get to see at that point from that perspective as a Korean when the IMF bailed out the country is that actually even the idea of a sovereign currency in itself is futile in the context of the strength of the dollar and how much of global finance is actually not what you think it is. Like the IMF is a hugely politicized institution if you grew up in Korea. And then, of course, in the US, you would not really experience the energy at all. You would actually think about it as like a very neutral entity that is meant to promote emerging market wealth. But there's adversarial stories across these dimensions you only get to see on the other side. And so, you know, I think about these formative experiences I've had where truth in itself is actually sometimes a little bit ambiguous. And you know, in empirical science, there can be things that are right and wrong. That's why the scientific method exists and hypothesis testing. But in social sciences, very rarely is anything ever actually truth. And that's why when people complain about misinformation, they think the opposite of misinformation is truth. But I tell them all the time, no, those are false equivalents. The opposite of misinformation is state-controlled information, actually. Because truth just exists on a spectrum of those two corners. And it's up to you to decide where you sit between this misinformation or state-controlled information in the gradients that it exists. And to me, a lot of the movement about crypto and Bitcoin in particular is to explicitly attack that vector of imagining a solution that is a little bit more geared towards a movement that understands that concept and challenges that concept, which is important to me. So maybe a part of it is I'll always be a trader and I love trading volatility and I will geek out on that all the time. But to me, part of what fulfills it is that long-term mission is actually a really important one for society as well.
For sure. I mean, I couldn't agree anymore, and I love the way you put it too. And I think the last part about the social science not being hard truths. I actually I think it was part of when I was reading through the radical portfolio theory that I actually got this quote down over here because I wanted to ask you about it. I love that a lot. While we're on this philosophical bent of Bitcoin, which is over time I've come to appreciate more and more. And I guess, especially with like things that have come up recently. Another thing you wrote down, I quoted here, you said when you were speaking specifically about the Bitcoin companies, that they must embrace the same vision of classical liberalism as individuals to pursue freedom, decentralization, and unity. I've always thought that either many of the founding fathers or at least like Thomas Jefferson, I thought specifically would loved like Bitcoin. Am I thinking along the same lines as like when you're mentioning classical liberalism?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the notion really goes back to even the founding history of this country, which is that the idea of being taxed at a level that you felt was disproportionate to individual interest versus the state is actually very deeply rooted in why the United States exists. And if you then go back and look at the founding fathers, the common message you'll see in how they have imagined things would look different here in the US would have been this idea that public debt is actually evil, right? There's a lot of like language around how public debt is the sin of all things at the sovereign level, which kills the individual. And at all costs, we must abolish like the idea of national debt and taxation at the level that is undue to suppress individualism. And Alexander Hamilton has been vocal about it, Thomas Jefferson, and it's actually like deeply rooted in the United States. When the US like first financed its war through its ex through the requisition of its debt against the British, I was shocked by how big or small that number can appear to you today. I'm curious, right, JJ, how much do you think the US was in debt by the time that the Revolutionary War was won, if you had to guess a number?
I should know this because I read about this shit all the time. Oh man, I'm gonna say, I don't know why I want to say like 10 mil.
No, you're trying to over, I think, index to the surprising thing, which is that there's been so much inflation in this war that these numbers all look kind of small in relative terms. It's actually about $75 million
Okay.
in total. I think it's like 50 federal, 25 across the states. And when you think about that, it's kind of shocking because like 75 million is like what Saylor buys a week now in Bitcoin on a bad week.
On a bad week, yeah. Jeez.
So it just shows you like how much of the discourse, even within like our politics, has changed so much, where the things we're arguing about was literally at the antithesis of like the founding history. And that's why I think Bitcoin long term is a pro-America story. Because if you believe in this public debt and government debt being in itself like a unproductive thing at an expansive level, then Bitcoin can be the counter thesis to that, as a country can adopt a more useful funding mechanism in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. So I hit the under way too small on that one, 10 mil. I don't know. I'm not good with the adjusting for inflation or I don't
It's
know.
okay. I'm trying to ask you to do a
Jeff, can I
300
just?
plus year of NPV discount rate calculation. So,
Well, you know,
no.
it's funny because I feel like I should know this because I've been reading on like especially like one of the recent books I've been reading, Jeff, on how the founding fathers like all like they were highly influenced by the Greeks and the Romans and that like that classical liberalism and then how that went to the Renaissance now to the founding fathers and just reading some of the things like you're saying like how in line at least in my mind it is with like Bitcoin and like just how their aversion to public debt and aversion just to like government in general it's just fascinating and I guess maybe like these things aren't taught in that manner anymore I suppose Jeff, are you familiar with Jason Lowry's power projection thesis for Bitcoin?
I'm not sure if I am. Is it related to just like the general power law, as like the Giovanni and
It's
crew have promoted, or is it different?
I'm gonna do my best. I this is like so he's so Major Jason Lowry of the United States Space Force. He wrote a PhD thesis for MIT, and I attempted to read it. I listened to like these guys did a fantastic podcast, kind of like recapping the thesis. God, it's almost like God, it's all complex. I'm gonna do a bad job of I'm gonna butcher the thesis, but power projection as like we're as like humans it, like war becomes more and more destructive. That we're going to fight for cyberspace essentially, and like Bitcoin being almost like a military deterrent. He even mentioned it could be eventually under the Second Amendment rights. So I don't know. I was just curious if you were familiar with this and what you thought of it, because I think some people find it controversial and just out there. I find it kind of interesting, but I was just going to be curious to see if you heard of it and what you thought about it. But
No, you've given me a little homework and I will look into it. But the thing that you're reminding me is another kind of reference material in poli sci history is Samuel Huntington's Clash of the Civilizations. It kind of draws a thesis as to how the eternal conflict among civilizations is rooted in a variety of different factors. And I think about Bitcoin a lot in that lens too, because much like I think the current chasm emerging across globalization and the populist movement, feeling like it's a relatable story across the whole country. Meaning, like the conflict in the United States with the class warfare is not an American story. It's actually a pretty global story. You hear the same story everywhere
yeah.
as to kind of like the uprising against the global elite. And so what you're realizing is like actually the line, this clash of civilization line that Samuel Huntington draws usually has like a more of a cultural border and a geopolitical border, but it's actually it's not entirely true. That border can be rewritten now at a global level where communications are happening in almost instant ways where you might find more relatable people offshore than onshore that have the same problems and virtues that you do, and they're not foreigners anymore. You're actually it's like a united class at a global level. And I do think there are elements of this redrawing some of these conflict lines where I think about Bitcoiners a lot, because one thing I've noticed is like wherever you travel in the world, like if you meet Bitcoiners, chances are you probably have a lot more common things with that person than almost any other factor you can model for, whether it's like age or ethnicity or gender. Like just knowing they're a Bitcoiner in whatever country gives you like almost 70% of like common interest and common overlap to have a meaningful kind of alignment. And I think a lot of people have spoken about this. You know, Balaji talks about the network state and how to redraw like these things. And I think that's why Bitcoin has also been so politicized and at the center of like, you know, the Trump administration and the way that it's now being leveraged amongst politicians to create some movement, right? Eric Adams embracing Bitcoin here at the eve of New York City's having these, you know, crazy Democratic primary races is in itself like an astounding thing. And so you're going to see, I think, more of that Bitcoin entering the culture of the political arena in a pretty meaningful way too, where that conflict resolution might just look different.
Yep, sure. We just got to take a quick time out here to announce the rebranding of our trading Discord server to the Trading Syndicate. We offer not only ES trading, where JJ teaches and trades, but other futures, instruments, stocks, of course, crypto. And also, we have a DFS and sports betting channel, which I'm highly active in. You can come visit us at tradingsyndicate.org. All right, Jeff, transitioning to neat theory that you have, the radical portfolio theory that you propose challenges the traditional 60-40 model that's been just widely accepted. So could you tell us a little bit about the theory, what your 60-40 allocation you propose, and just summarize everything.
Sure. So, yeah, at the root cause of why I went down this exploration is because I felt that there's a voice that is lacking in the current industry that is able to be persuasive about why 60-40 is broken in a way that makes sense. And what I realized is like the numbers speak for themselves at times, and you can point to different charts and bars and show you the high correlation, bonds and equities failing together and whatnot. But you actually need to like then unfold it like why is this happening and actually make it like understandable to me, especially for the young generation who's only seen the investing world post 2008, which is such a different world than pre 2008. And the common theme I think underlying here is that the rise of like global liquidity as a phenomenon is extremely perverse and extremely significant, where cross-border flows and and how governments intervene in those flows become more important than almost any other thing that you can think through in the traditional investing model. So the thing about 60-40 that I think is misguided is that it really talks about equities and bonds being diversifiers because one is risk on and one is risk off, or one is pro growth and one is pro safety, and they hedge recession risks. But what you realize is actually equities no longer behave in a way that seems to reflect growth. And you can almost see this because even performance of equities across this index constituents look pretty dire. Meaning, if you take out like the Mag 7 or like the top companies, the other companies are just kind of lagging and they're not actually doing much at all. Like, I think there's lots of studies that have shown you, like, beneath the surface of the largest companies in the United States, there actually has not been that much growth. And so, what does that mean? It means that equities has also become like a proxy to fight inflation by being a thing where people can just put their money in as a hedge to inflation, which in itself sounds like the kind of things that you would invest in for bonds. And because of this nature of it, when you own 60/40, you actually own 100 of something, and it's the same risk. And that same risk that you're owning is basically the global carry trade, because the global carry trade is actually circular. And so when you have Japan buying US equities that then is funded by US debt that is then funded by the yen carry trade, it's all actually the same thing. So the thing you realize is, wait, I need to diversify away from this entire system. I need 40 of something else that's just not part of this apparatus. And that's what my radical portfolio theory is deeply trying to explore, which is, hey, what other assets are there that is not participating in this cyclical apparatus? And let's walk through those examples and see how each individual investor can be empowered to think differently about what the future holds and how they're going to be able to safeguard and protect their assets in the way that it deserves for the modern era. And so, in that lens, I really talk about kind of three prongs. One is there are censorship resistant assets that I think hold value outside of that global carry apparatus. Things like that include Bitcoin and gold. And those things have unique features about it where the actual creation of those assets are both energy consuming in ways that isn't just liquidity transformation, which in itself gives them scarcity, which in itself makes them valuable. And that's not how the rest of fiat-based assets behave when the underlying anchor is liquidity transformation. The second asset class that I think is really profound, I call it professional gambling. But I do think, going back to Ray, your history with poker, it's such an important concept that young people really must learn. And I say this from the bottom of my heart, where truly, in the age of AI and the age of information overload, where there's no more edge in actually being able to kind of be the expert of something by brute memorization or brute pattern recognition, you really then have to think about a world where those values are becoming commoditized. And the thing then you have to imagine is like, well, then what are humans really useful for? Well, humans are useful because they're actually the ones still creating information. And so, like, professional gambling to me implies a sense of understanding the probabilistic outcome of those events. So poker is incredible because it really helps people think about probabilistic outcomes and bet accordingly to the ways where you have a positive EV outcome. And if you extrapolate that one step further, there's many ways that's going to be possible, including betting on Polymarket, for example. Like, I am actually a huge fan of Polymarket because I think Polymarket has one of the incredible democratic forces where anyone, you, me, JJ, can all bet on information where we think we bring an edge and therefore have a positive EV experience that can't be overwhelmed by institutional flows. It's actually why sports betting is actually a really profitable endeavor for those who really know what they're doing. And the whole business of sports betting is actually made such that even the markets are tightened by the initial kind of professional bettors, where they're essentially subsidizing the market making business. And so that aspect of like professional gambling, where the individual has the edge, I think needs to be a part of a way to think about human capital as an asset class. And I think there's features about it where you can also invest in the future as an asset class in that way through the partnership of third parties that I'm really interested in. And then the third thing I'll mention is culture. Culture also, by definition, is scarce, and by the time that it becomes expendable, it's not actually culture anymore. It's actually just not valuable. And so culture also strives on a similar notion of value creation by scarcity, and there are different ways you can invest in culture too. Billionaires have done it by buying sports teams, for example, or young kids buy Pokemon cards and everything in between. But the idea is that there are different assets that encapsulate this culture IP that is also deserving of a role in your portfolio where it can hold value better if people believe that culture is important and they also want the same thing.
Super fascinating on many fronts. I think what I would like to ask you, Jeff, like to maybe help like illustrate this for the audience and the listeners. So you break down your 60-40 portfolio as like 60 is compliance, right? You label it compliance and then the 40 resistance. So for the 60% compliance, like what would that include? And sorry if you already said that. I just want to, just for the audience, make it clear.
Yeah, I think that 60 is basically the 100 of anything you'll ever hear from your financial advisors to tell you how to think about your portfolio. So it's public equity, it's public debt, private equity, private credit. I would say there is this notion that alternatives as an asset class is somewhat of like a 40% allocation, but I actually think it's just 60% bucket of compliance. It's just the duration profile has changed. And here's a little dirty secret. One way that I think financial advisors try to think that you're diversified is by helping you change the duration profile and then changing the liquidity terms where it feels different, right? So when the endowments are saying they're very invested in private equity and, Harvard for a long time had a bunch of timberland in New Zealand as part of like an investment program, they look like they're diversifying you because there's no marks, it's not liquid, and it's long duration. So it feels diverse, but it's not. It's not because the buyers and sellers are generally kind of similar if they're institutional flows. And so all of that like diversification of alts is to me part of 60. And then where the 40 really, as you mentioned, is talking about being resistance assets, has to come from some fundamental assumptions that you have to really enforce. One of those assumptions is that these assets have to be opposite of the global carry trade. They have to be short global carry. So what does that mean? How do you become short global carry? Global carry works because there's basically a lot of liquidity on very low vol things, and you put a lot of leverage on it. That's actually what global carry is. So now you have to kind of close your eyes and do the exact opposite. What has very little liquidity, but also as a result might be very volatile, and also has the therefore lack of ability to put leverage on it.
Got it.
That's the resistance assets. So think about, for example, like a great Picasso work, right? Very rare. There's definitely no liquidity. And also when it does trade, very volatile because the price is all over the place. And you can't really put leverage on that thing because nobody knows what the actual price is. So it's perfect. Like that's actually the thing you want because even though it's not what you're used to being pitched, where you want assets that are like very liquid, low vol, high leverage, that's what makes the defining characteristic of a resistance asset so valuable. And I put a little asterisk next to Bitcoin because Bitcoin happens to actually be maybe the exception to this rule, where not only is it like very volatile, but it actually does also have a ton of liquidity and volatility. And volume tends to be also inversely related. Bitcoin is maybe the exception to this rule just because of the global phenomenon for which there's so much interest across the supply and demand curve, in which the price action is also set by the marginal because in the end, it's a commodity less so than, a fiat-based technocratic manipulatable asset.
How do you guys, sorry, let me just jump in real quick on the business side of things. When Hunter was on, we were talking because I'm a trader and a, size trader back in the day. So how do you size into these markets? At first, it was really difficult. Has the market improved for liquidity for you guys now to execute your strategies? I know, you do the let the math do the talking, but how is the, putting on size in this Bitcoin market with such limited supply? There's only 21 million coins. So, when you guys come in to transact, do you find it better now than it was like a year ago when we had Hunter on?
I think the answer is yes. Absolutely. Yes. And it's and I'll tell you, some of it is because what Wall Street is really good at is essentially lubricating that engine for better or for worse. So,
Gotta grease those wheels, yep.
I mean, the whole business of Wall Street is, can we bring scale? Can we bring lots of
Exactly.
volume? And then can we actually kind of put some leverage on it, right? And
Nice,
so
yeah.
this idea of the Bitcoin spot ETF in itself being a little bit more useful than Bitcoin as a cold storage collateral is appealing to a lot of different folks, because Bitcoin itself can also be used in the ETF ecosystem as part of the borrow market, where you're able to earn basically a return on it, right? Whereas in Bitcoin world, the challenges there is, like, you have counterparty risk all the time if you were actually
Exactly.
lending out your assets, right? This is the horror of Genesis and Celsius and all that stuff. But with Bitcoin ETFs, you almost will never have that problem, because there is a clearing mechanism for there being a custodian. So Wall Street's good at a few things, and one of this is actually financializing assets so that they're more productive in the way that we understand credit creation. And because of that, liquidity can exist in different dimensions that historically would not have been possible with just the Bitcoin spot.
Got
So
it.
I think it has improved. That's also why I think you're seeing a lot of financial innovations happening with structured products. People are looking for different structured payouts using Bitcoin, where you can do call spreads, put spread collars, and things much more easily as a wrapped retail high net worth product from a distribution channel. And I think you're going to see more of those things come through the credit world too, where people are now focused on securitization. Like, how do you think about lending in Bitcoin, where then you can apply the tried and tested rules of securitization, where there's a senior float, a junior float, a mezzanine float, and these things, it's not native to Bitcoiners who might otherwise feel like this is bastardizing the mission of what Bitcoin in itself is meant to represent. But the
But
reality
it's
is,
creating, right? I mean, it must be really cool to go into work every day and be around people who are like-minded and create products. Now I'm looking at, you've got the Bitwise 10 crypto, you've got the, BITB, you've got all of these products that you didn't have a year ago. That you're creating. And that is, from someone who's taken companies public his whole life, that creating of, but this is even cooler because it's almost like you're creating this stuff out of thin air. It's like very Da Vinci-esque for me. It's very cool.
thank you. I hope we get to do more of these experimentations where we'll keep onboarding new class of crypto investors. I think that's ultimately what this journey is. Like, people come to crypto, but their intentions are always different. And the other thing you realize is that there are assumptions you hold, and then there are also assumptions that hold you. And the key is actually make yourself challenge the former and free yourself from the latter. And I think Bitcoin is really a very useful wedge to open people's eyes and minds towards that.
Definitely. I'm one of them. I'm 57 years old and I bought Bitcoin after we had Hunter on the podcast, 'cause
Amazing.
I was always freaked out about counterparty risk because, I had clients who would take down clearing firms for sport. So I was always, just like a nervous Nelly. And then he said, "No, we got this. We got this." Right. So I went in it. I don't even hold stock, but I own Bitcoin and I hold it. Yeah. It's very cool.
Amazing. Love to
Yeah.
hear it.
I can never get him over the years to do it, Jeff, but Hunter did.
No,
So
Hunter did it.
shout out
Yeah.
Hunter.
Let's go. Well, it's one thing Bitwise and Hunter can do all day long is to
Teach the old dog new tricks, why not?
Hey, Jeff, I got to ask you just one last question. And I'll let you get going, man. I really appreciate your time just because our audience is retail traders, retail investors. You say that every retail investor must learn to trade options. It's table stakes if you want to be in control to best institutions. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you saw yesterday, but Citadel sued with the SEC to stop IEX
Yes.
from coming into the options market. Okay,
I
great.
saw
JJ,
that.
you saw that. I think that there's not enough eyes on it, but this is literally at the core the philosophical debate that is happening as to, what is a healthy market structure. And I think what people are going to start realizing is that there's a lot of asymmetric information in markets. And then there's also a lot of ways that retail can be disadvantaged versus institutions. And you have to counteract this in the best way possible as a retail investor And one of the ways you can do this is via options. And the reason I think the options market is so important is because let's think about what retail is really good at. Retail is really good at basically being anonymous, right? You don't have to file forms to show public ownership of anything, really, unless you go for a certain size. And then two, you don't need to trade a lot as a retail investor relative to your own portion. And so the third thing is what is retail disadvantaged by? Well, basically they're disadvantaged by flows, and then they actually have to pay probably more in commission because of the footprint that they leave being smaller, and they're not getting best terms. So if when you put all these things together, the options market's really almost tailor-made for retail because one, institutions will leave footprints when they trade options. It's really obvious when they trade big prints because the size relative to option contract and open interest becomes knowable. But it's not easy to make your footprint known as a retail investor. So that means you can actually put on more size via options than you probably, on a relative basis, find an edge versus Delta One. And then the second thing is options inherently have gamma. So it grows in notional exposure with convexity without you having to churn trading. So what that means is you can just buy something and hold it for a long time and not overtrade it, and it organically kind of grows with you where you don't have to churn it the way institutions have to churn and trade at a discount. And then I think the third thing really is like going back to where you can have an outsized influence, like relative to others, and that becomes more obvious for retail, where their flows matter a lot more in options than it ever will in Delta One. And because of all these reasons, I think options provide a certain structural advantage for retail, but at the same time, options trading is hard, and you guys all know it. Most
Yeah.
people don't know how to do it, and so, the thing that I would love to enthuse more for young people is just learn it sooner. Learn how options trading actually works. Learn the Greeks. Learn what, put call parity is. Learn what a delta hedging replication portfolio is. Learn like volatility swaps and variance swaps and all these things, because in the end, like, that's actually the direction of where the world is going. Like, hyper financialization is here. 0-day expiry options are here. 2x levered ETFs are here, and negative 2x levered ETFs are here. So all of the things are pointing towards a direction where everyone needs to like level up a little bit to participate meaningfully in this market, whether you like it or not. And at the core of all of this is the necessity to think in a probabilistic lens. And options trading is the best tool that will help you understand the world from that model of a normal distribution. So that's my quick pitch for everyone to get smarter on options trading, and it'll help your life in many ways, I think, even beyond finance. I think it'll just help you think more clearly about all the world events, all the rights and wrongs of the debates that you will be thrust into the future, where AI is going and where you might feel like you have an edge against AI. It'll come down to these probabilistic models, because AI ultimately, as you know, is quite deterministic.
Yep. Great stuff. And that's going to conclude today's episodes of Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed the episode, please rate and review it for us. If you'd like to join a supportive and professional community of traders, you can join us at thetradingsyndicate.com. Jeff, let the listeners know where they can find you and anything else you want them to know.
Yep, you can find me on X, Twitter. My handle is DGT10011. Otherwise, you can find me on bitwiseinvestments.com.
Yep. We'll put the handle in the description. Also, the Substack. Follow a Substack. A lot of great stuff to read through there. Highly recommend it. So for Jeff Park, I'm John Studd. He's the gorilla of House Street. You stop so.